Alrighty, Paul, welcome to At the Hop.
Well, thank you.
It's nice to have you here. I couldn't get any sleep last night. I was just so excited to talk to you.
Well, I confess I got plenty of sleep.
Oh, excellent. You're like the first movie star, television actor I've had on my show, so I get a little nervous sometimes.
Oh, you mustn't be.
Yeah.
Just a conversation about things we have both lived through.
I know. How did your journey begin, Paul?
Well, I try to tell the truth to people because I got started when I was, 9 years old. The fact is, Mom was bigger than me. I was taking lessons in singing and dancing, and because we were living in North Hollywood, it was pretty easy to go out on the first open audition, which was for the Mouseketeers. And even with all the kids they had there trying out, I was able to become one of the original Mouseketeers. And that was a sea change, believe me.
And what age were you at that time?
I was 9.
9.
This was the summer, actually late spring of 1955.
That's cool. And what kind of theater, did you do theater back then, or were you
well,
on TV
I,
right
I
away?
I did a lot of theater, but it was performance. I sang and I danced, so I was doing things like the VA, Wadsworth Theater, a local talent show here called Rocket to Stardom, singing competitively and ending up singing in the Hollywood Bowl, that kind of stuff. So I was at least with the kids with some talent, I was pretty well known because I was winning every contest I got into.
And did you enjoy that experience?
Well, I enjoyed the performances. It finally made all the practice and all of that drama worthwhile. There's such a difference between the practice that you do and then getting the audience feedback with a live performance. So, yes, I enjoyed the performances, but, God, the practice was grueling.
Yeah. How did you land the role in the 1957 film Houseboat?
Well, between The Mouseketeers and Houseboat, which occurred about 2 years later, I had begun to work quite a bit as a kid in Hollywood, getting pretty good parts on Playhouse 90, Ford Theater, national commercials. And, for a youngster in Hollywood, your career takes off very quickly. There's a kind of narrow window in which your success is noted by the industry's casting directors and all the rest. So by the time I got to Houseboat, I was considered, a professional, accomplished child. And Cary Grant made the final decision, and I was delighted because it was one of the great movie experiences of my life. It was 7 months of production, more than half of which took place in Washington, D.C., and it was great.
And what role did you play in that movie?
Well, I played David, Cary Grant's oldest son. My little sister was Mimi Gibson. And my little brother was Charlie Herbert, who people might remember from 13 Steps or the original Fly.
Excellent. And how did you feel after doing that movie? Did you feel like you did a good job? Were you pleased?
I was extremely pleased. First of all, making friends on a major project like that is always heartwarming. And Mr. Grant, whom I called Mr. G., was very complimentary towards me, shared that with my mom. Making friends with Sophia Loren was fabulous. I mean, even though I was 12, I knew she was something special.
Yeah.
And the movie was well received. The music was great. The people I worked with was they were all fabulous. And, of course, it led directly the following year to the tests and subsequent casting of the Donna Reed Show.
Yeah, let's talk about the Donna Reed Show. You played Jeff Stone on that show, am I correct?
No, I did for 8 years, from age 12 to 20.
Now, what were the other members of that cast right there, that
TV show?
Well,
we had Donna Reed, of course, who was an Academy Award-winning actress. She'd won the Oscar for her role as Alma, the prostitute, in From Here to Eternity. Carl Betts played the father, Dr. Alexander Stone. This was a Carnegie Award winner from his college days. In fact, he shared the Carnegie Award with Robert Ludlum, the world-famous novelist. And then Shelley Fabre was my sister, which Shelley and I laugh about this all the time. The previous year, we had actually been cast as brother and sister on a show that never made anything more than the pilot, called The Sherry Lewis Show. So Shelley and I had our act down. We had the, you know, pesky younger brother, long-suffering older sister parts down cold. And we had a ball.
What episode do you remember most about being on that show?
Well, there was, you know, oh gosh, so many stand out. I think the ones people remember after all this time was the original pilot episode called The Boxing Lesson, where Donna has to teach me to box. But then, of course, the much-favored My Dad episode, where I got to sing the classic Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil song to Carl Betts on the show. The episode was a perfect setup. Dr. Alexander Stone was a pediatrician who was constantly being called away from family plans. And this episode allowed Jeff, my character, to sing a wonderful tune called My Dad to Carl Betts. And it touched a lot of hearts back then and still to this day.
Paul, how did you ever decide to start singing? Because you were an actor first, am I correct?
Well, that's true, but I had started as an actor and a singer, so I have never been shy around microphones. But the truth is, Ricky Nelson had already created this thing called the Bubblegum Star. You know, if you're an adolescent on a TV show and you can warble just a little bit, you'll get a record contract. And that's what happened to me and Shelley Fabre. And, of course, Shelley's huge hit, Johnny Angel, came right out of the box. And at exactly the same time period, I had pretty good success with a novelty song called She Can't Find Your Keys, and followed by My Dad. So it was a singing career that took advantage of the very public face of being on a successful family show.
That's excellent. Now, did you go on tour because you were making this music, or how did you promote it?
Well, actually, I did. Shelley did not go on tour, but given the work schedule he had. Now, remember, in those days of television, you filmed basically 39 episodes per year, which means I only had 13 open weeks. But during the summer, I would go off for 6 or 7 weeks with the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars and tour the country. And by the way, I loved it. It was great fun because I was on the road with some big-time acts, the Supremes, Tom Jones, Gene Pitney, the Drifters. How cool is that?
That's awesome. Those are some of my idols right there, Paul. You're making me jealous.
Well,
oh, yeah.
I'll tell you, for me, as a kid from a television show, I was never deluded into thinking that I was competing for top 10 records with these people that I just mentioned. I was in awe of them. To be able to sit on a bus in the dead of night going from one gig to the next and to hear Abdul playing guitar softly and Diana Ross and Mary Wilson singing songs, I mean, it was fabulous.
Yeah, we had Mary Wilson at Rock On in New Jersey.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
nice lady.
I was there as well, and boy, she tells wonderful stories, and I so admire her.
Yeah. Hey, is it true you were on the Motown record label?
That's true. I was the first white artist they signed.
That caught me by surprise, Paul. That's really amazing.
Well,
I never would have guessed that.
I don't think you should be surprised. If you can just think back to those days, if you were even around then, I certainly was, there were a lot of troubles in this country when it came to race.
Yeah.
And we were confronted by that while we were on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars. And I confess, as a youngster feeling very full of himself, I took offense to segregated eating facilities and all the rest, and I was quite vocal about it. And that word got back to Barry Gordon. And when my contract with Colpix was over, he was nice enough to extend the hand of friendship and a contract. And even though I didn't have a big hit with Motown, it was a great experience.
So what were the total of hits you had on Colpix Records? Can you name them for us, please?
Well, let's see. My Dad and She Can't Find Your Keys. Then the Carole King song, Keep Your Love Locked. I had a wonderful song that Brian Wilson wrote for me called She Rides With Me. I had Lollipops and Roses. And then we had three or four albums. Jimmy Darin, who was also under contract, and Shelley and I did two albums called Teenage Triangle. And they were pretty popular back in the day.
Excellent. And let's see here. So your contract ended with Colpix Records, so that's how you got to Motown Records?
Yes, that's correct. It was a very peculiar situation when Colpix folded, because every act they had, including the Marcells, had, you know, big hit tunes. But we are talking about the record business.
So I actually didn't know that. So the label actually went out of business, Colpix?
Yes, it did. And it reemerged as a thing called Coal Gems. In time to catch the monkey wave.
Yeah. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I tell you, the history of individual labels within the record business is, they're very interesting. Let me be kind and say they're interesting.
Because the Marcells, that was a big group in the early 1960s for doo-wop and songs like that.
Oh, my God. Can you have a bigger hit than Blue Moon than their version?
Yeah. That's excellent. How did She Can't Find Her Keys come to be?
Well, Stu Phillips, who was our A&R guy and a wonderful man I'm still friends with, he just celebrated his 80th birthday. He found this novelty song, which he took to Tony Owen, who was our producer. Now, Tony was married to Donna Reed. And he said to Tony, you know, this would be a very cute dream sequence. If we have Jeff coming to the front door with his girlfriend and she's got no way to get in the house and she's pulling all of these unusual items out of her purse. And Tony liked the idea, and in fact we did it on the Donna Reed Show with a dream sequence, because it really is kind of a humorous, the lyrics are really quite fun.
Yeah, it's amazing all the stuff she pulls out and you're just waiting for your kiss. It's funny.
Exactly. And, of course, the net-net on that song was that people forever confused me and Brian Hyland.
Yeah.
Because he had the song Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini.
Yeah.
And we were always saying, no, that's Brian's song. No, that's Peterson's song.
You know, now that you said that, Paul, you do sound a little bit alike, I think, too, now
that
you've said that.
And I think, you know, novelty records hold a special place for all of us, whether it's the Chipmunk song or Elmo's song, Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer.
Yeah.
I got to meet him at RockCon, and that was fun.
Yeah, you know, actually a kid from the New York station brought him over to me. I never thought he'd be there, but then all of a sudden he sounds just like the record. I was amazed.
Oh, he sounds
just like that record.
Yeah,
wow.
We met him down in the hotel lobby, and he came over. Someone introduced us. And as we were shaking hands, I looked down. The guy's wearing yellow tennis shoes.
I know. It's awesome. Yeah. He's actually on one of my lists to interview, actually.
Well, you should. He actually has a great story to tell. And, of course, he views his success, his recording success, with a great deal of humor, and that makes it fun.
Yeah. Going back one more time to She Can't Find Her Keys, I get a lot of calls from listeners sometimes. Who is the girl singing with you in the background of that song?
Well, we had a group of gals who sang backup on all my records, and they went by the name of The Blossoms. And I apologize for not knowing their individual names, but these were professional stand-up background singers who were constantly being employed in sessions. You know, in my day, my guitar player on the sessions was, I'm going to forget his name. Oh, God, that's not good. The guy who did By the Time I Get, Glenn Campbell.
Glenn Campbell, yeah.
That was who played lead guitar for me. But, you know, studio musicians in that day, they played hundreds of dates in the course of a year. At least the good ones did.
Because that's always been one thing that does kind of catch my eye about the 50s and early 60s music. There seems to be a lot of voices and things in the background that we never know who they are. You know what I mean?
Well, because they were professionals. You know, to this day, over at AFTRA, which is a union, I'm on the national board and local board, we have a singers caucus, and I'm telling you, I watch these singers perform in some of the events that we have. These are real pros. They all can sight read. They can put together a harmony that just blow your socks off, and they do it with such ease because they are professional singers.
Do you remember doing a song, Keep Your Love Locked? Is that the name
of
it?
Sure, that was Carole King's song.
Yeah, I get requests for that on my radio show.
Well, it's a good song. I mean, Carole, even then, before her own individual success when she was on A&M, she wrote just wonderful story songs where you understood the teenage angst, and she was able to capture that beautifully.
Oh, I think she was a genius. I play some of her records on Dimension record label, and people are just amazed that that's Carole King, because it tends to be this day, especially in the Boston area, we hear so much of her later songs, but then when I start playing the earlier stuff, people just go crazy. It's amazing.
Well, exactly, but just think what it was when she was working her tail off at the Brill Building.
Yeah.
You know, those were some extraordinary songwriters back in the day. We're talking from the late 50s forward. That were actually working right there next to Times Square, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. Holy smoke, when I met them, I nearly kissed their rings. I mean, these people had already written on Broadway. Of course, the Righteous Brothers had that huge hit, You Lost That Love and Feeling. So I was awestruck when Barry brought his very treasured song to my attention.
That's amazing. I would have been happy, too. Wow, that's amazing.
Well, I tell people this story who play records. Imagine this scenario. I'm in Las Vegas celebrating New Year's, and on New Year's morning, about 8 o'clock, I get a call from Lou Adler, who was with Colpix at the time. Paul, get down to the recording studio right now. And I said, well, Lou, I'm in Las Vegas. He said, Paul, Brian Wilson has written a song for you. We're going to record it today. He's got an open day. I was on a plane within a half hour and in L.A. and in the recording studio with those two as quick as I could get there, about 2 hours. And we got to do that, She Rides With Me, which is a fun song.
Yeah. What was that song? Lollipops and Roses. How did that come to be?
Well, actually, you know, that was a hit back in my father's day. And when Jack Jones had a version that came out, you know, and it's a wonderful thing. I mean, tell her you care each time you meet. We were doing an album because of the success of my dad, which featured songs that my father loved. And he had always liked that song, and Stu did a wonderful arrangement, and we took it into the studio, and I had a great deal of fun recording it. And the truth is, and Jack will tell you the same thing, I sold about 3 times as many records as he did.
That's amazing. Now, you didn't have any big hits on Motown Records, am I correct?
No, I never did. They were, you know, they were covered. And look, it was a very unusual time of people out on the road promoting, you know, the Supremes and Drifters and Smokey Robinson and the Temps, they didn't quite know what to do with me. And I understood that. It was an honor just to be there.
How did you leave eventually, or did you stay a while?
No, I was actually there for, I think, about 18 months, and it was a very amicable parting of the ways. You know, it's very difficult to change a company's character. And I didn't have a breakout hit tune to make people understand that Motown was trying to branch out. But that's okay, because the experience was positive. And I mean, look at this. I get bragging rights to being the first white guy on the label forever.
That's something to be proud of, yeah. That caught me by surprise. That was like, wow, because you always think of the Supremes, Marvin Gaye, Smokey Robinson, the Miracles.
Sure.
And especially a lot of groups seemed like there were more groups on that record label.
Well, I think so. But look, those were heady days.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I came to the headquarters, okay, these Motown's headquarters, and it's three residential facilities kind of all wired together on a perfectly ordinary wide street, and I'm saying hello to people on the front porch, and here comes Stevie Wonder bouncing out of a car and without any assistance up the walk into the buildings right to a recording studio.
So did you met Stevie Wonder? How was he?
Oh, sure. I pretty much knew all the guys anyway, guys and gals.
Yeah.
But I can remember Hal, when he took me around the facilities the first time, we went down in the recording studio, and we interrupted somebody. They were laying down tracks. And he said, "Get a load of this, Paul. The funk just drips off the wall."
Cool, yeah, yeah. Was the building called Hitsville, USA? Am I correct on that?
Well, I think that's what it became known as, but it wasn't a single building. It was three row homes, which Barry had bought the first one, and then he bought the one next door, and then the one on the other side, and they were all kind of wired together. You know, we're talking 1965, 66 now.
Yeah. And Berry Gordy, are you aware that he wrote songs for Jackie Wilson?
You know, I did know that. And, of course, I was a big fan of Jackie Wilson. Holy smoke. But Barry had a great ear for music. I remember being in his office and him asking me, he said, "Tell me what you think of this." And he put a record on, and the sound came out of a little tiny speaker sitting on his desk. And it was a car audio system. And I said, "What on earth are you using this for?" He said, "That's the way kids hear our music." And I thought, "Now that's pretty cool."
Yeah, yeah, that is cool. It's amazing. Just think of the sound systems they have today. It's amazing to go back to see those little record players.
Well, it's exactly true. I mean, you know, the technology may have changed significantly, but at the end of the day, at least for me, what I appreciate most are those acts that can come into a live performance and give you a broadcast quality sound. That they, you know, they're live performers. There are no sweeteners. Nobody is singing under the stage. They're doing their act. And that's how I appreciate them. And it doesn't matter if it comes out of a little, you know, 1960 transistor radio or out of a big system. If a song and an act has got the goods, they've got the goods.
Paul, have you ever moved from California? Did you ever live somewhere else at the point in life?
Yeah, I lived in Connecticut for almost 9 years.
Really?
I had gone back there in 60 or 71. And went back to school, lived in New Haven, and then moved to Wallingford, and then down to Westport, Connecticut. I was there for many years.
Wow.
And it helped change my life.
Yeah. Were you ever married?
Oh, well, I've been married 3 times. People who followed my career can list the wives for you.
Yeah.
But my third wife, Ronna, and I have been together 22 years now, and life is good.
That's excellent. As we got closer into the 1970s and 80s, were you busy or were you more like being a family?
Well, I had changed my life. When I moved back to Connecticut in 71, there were many things I had to deal with. My own sense of self. Hang on a second. Dog,
sure.
Hey! They love to bark at people.
What kind of dog is that?
Well, we got a little... these are two mongrels who were rescue dogs from Katrina.
Yeah.
So we got a little Scamper and Dusty.
That's
they
cool.
like to bark.
Yeah.
I had turned to a writing career when I moved back to Connecticut. And I was very fortunate to get a contract with Simon & Schuster. And it helped me change my attitude, my life. And I was able to publish 16 books during my time back there in Connecticut. So it was a very important change for me.
Well, you've definitely done a lot, Paul. It's amazing what you've done.
Well, I get, you know, just looking back sometimes, I am amazed.
Let's see.
I got a couple gold records, 16 published books, 8 years on a television show.
Yeah.
I guess I'm busy. But, of course, the most important work that I do is with our foundation, A Minor Consideration. That's the most important stuff.
Excellent.
Because we're making life better for kids in the business today.
Yeah, tell me about that. What do you do with that?
Well, it started back in January of 1990 because so many of my kid actor friends were in trouble. and I had been going to too many funerals. And my wife and I decided we were going to help as many people as we could who shared my kind of background. And I can remember thinking, well, you know, two or three former kid stars a year will be in trouble. But it soon outgrew my very low expectations until by the end of three or four years, we had 60 members. We were active in getting former kid stars into rehab. We were all over the media. And we identified certain structural problems in the employment of youngsters in the business. And we began addressing those issues quite successfully, I might say. I'm knocking on wood as I say it.
Yeah.
And we became known as very effective lobbyists, and we enjoyed the success of having significant laws passed to protect children.
That's excellent.
Well, nothing's changed, although the venues have changed a little bit. We have over 200 kids working on reality television shows right now, and they need better protections.
Yeah.
Because whether you call them reality shows or series television or big movies, the impact on the young children who are involved, the impacts will be the same.
Yeah.
And people have to, the industry itself has to look ahead 10, 15 years and say, now, what can we do better so the kids are better protected?
Yeah. Paul, what are you doing in the present day? Are you still around? You at Rock
Well,
On?
I have a television show here in Los Angeles, which is called Aging in L.A., because I'm very concerned with the issues surrounding seniors. You know, baby boomers, there's about 80 million of them, and very few of them have taken the care needed to provide for their security in their old age. I know of, in our membership, about 200 of our members currently are 65 and above. So I'm dealing with these issues for seniors all the time, and I'm very concerned that folks are not paying attention. So I do a television show here. I've been doing it for 5 years, and we've done 145 episodes. It's fun. It's fun for me.
Yeah, that's good. Are you going to be around any more concerts like Rock On? Where are you
going
to be next?
Well, I'd love to be asked. You know, I felt so honored to be there in the first place. Even with the bubblegum star kind of reputation, because at the end of the day, I was there. You know, I was on the road and friends with the people who were making popular music, and I felt very good when people came up to me and people who fondly remembered my recordings. So it felt good. If I'm asked, I'm apt to show up.
Yeah, I mean, it was an honor to meet you, Paul, because I get so many calls for you here. Of course, my show plays 50s and early 60s music, so you fit right in right here.
Yep, hey, I'm there.
Yeah.
But it was fun, and I do try to get out as often as I can.
That's excellent.
Even though, you know, I got a family and a new grandson, so I try to stay close to home, but that's not the way the world works anymore.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to say before I sign off?
I'm sorry, say again?
Anything else you'd like to say before I sign off?
Well, nothing specifically. We have, of course, Aging in L.A. will go on, and we have some, there's some interesting news, and I ask people to go on a Minor Considerations website or my Facebook page, and they can keep track.
And what is your website, Paul?
The website is www.minorcon, that's MinorCon.org. We are a tax-free foundation, and a minor consideration is really the focus of my life these days.
Oh, okay. And is any of your music available for purchasing?
Well, I think you can find it all over the place. I mean, there's a Best of Paul Peterson album. Teenage Triangles are still bartered and sold. So they're available. And, of course, people can buy the first three seasons of The Donna Reed Show on DVD. So this is one of those things where you go to Amazon.com, or if you're looking for out-of-print books, you know, you go to eBay. You'll find me out there.
Yeah, that's excellent. Alrighty, Paul, well, I thank you for talking to me.
Oh, absolutely. The pleasure was mine, and thanks so much. Take care.